Hello, I'm Arnold Hamilton, editor of the Oklahoma Observer.
And I'm Marianne Martin, and this is ObserverCast, your weekly deep dive into Oklahoma politics and policy.
Presented by the Mary Lou Lemon Foundation.
If nothing else, the Oklahoma legislature's Republican supermajority has proven itself world-class at one thing, virtue signaling. Any piece of legislation they can remotely link to DEI or ESG, anything they can tar and feather as woke, anything they think undermines the historical, patriarchal, white status quo, they attack like buzzards feasting on roadkill. Knowing such legislative action will thrill the extremists in their base who live in constant fear that others who don't look or act or pray or love like they do are somehow getting the upper hand in modern America. Sadly, such political showboating crowds out the heavy lifting necessary to devise and enact serious public policy that actually would help workaday Oklahomans. Adding insult to injury, these indefensible, unnecessary, and often unconstitutional new laws end up being overturned in court, wasting precious tax dollars that could be invested in schools, healthcare, roads, and other essential public services. In case you missed it, the state just lost another court case over a recently enacted performance policy when a state district judge permanently banned enforcement of the so-called Oklahoma Energy Discrimination Act, designed to prohibit the state from doing business with financial institutions it identified as hostile to the oil and gas industry. That included state pension systems investing with financial institutions put on a naughty list by the state treasurer because their ESG policies, oh, there's that acronym, environmental, social, and governance policies, were deemed harmful to the state's energy industry. Blacklisted companies included such financial juggernauts as BlackRock, Wells Fargo, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, State Street, Barclays, Climate First Bank. Well, former Democratic State Representative Colin Waelke was in the legislature when this law was enacted. Now in private practice, Waelke is representing those who have successfully challenged the law on the grounds that it could prevent state pension systems from maximizing returns for state retirees. Well, the case is not over, of course. Attorney General Gentner Drummond has promised to appeal. But Waelke joins us for this week's ObserverCast to take a deep dive into yet another legislative solution to a problem that doesn't exist. Well, Colin, it's great to have you today. It's great to see you. Miss your smiling, usually, not always, but often smiling presence around the dome. Hey, bring people up to date on what you've been doing in the couple of years since you've been gone from the 23rd and Lincoln Wars.
So I've been practicing law at the law firm of Hall Estill, and I lead their cybersecurity and data privacy practice group, which, if you'll recall, while I was in the legislature, that was my passion, was data privacy legislation, to everyone's annoyance. So that's led to a lot of great opportunities working in the AI space and those sorts of things. Still doing litigation and business transactions and still involved in the community, still trying to help support Democrats and other good candidates out there. So, that's what I'm doing now.
Good for you. Well, here we are. You're now on the other side of a, piece of legislation that passed when you were in the legislature, and it was not something that you voted for, and you knew what was happening, what was at work here. But take us back to your recollection of kind of what was behind this legislation and what the arguments were for and against it at the time.
So we knew where the background of it came from because it was a literal and copy and paste job from another ALEC bill that prohibited states from doing business with companies that boycotted Israel. And so in this particular statute, they literally just changed the word boycott Israel to boycott energy company. The problem is syntactically, that's impossible to use in a sentence, boycott energy company. And in fact, the very definition doesn't exist anywhere in the statute. So, because it's always used in the plural. But in any event, and the rationale behind the law was basically, we don't want our businesses to invest in, or we don't want state funds invested in businesses that will be detrimental to the oil and gas industry. And it was Representative Mark McBride that ran the legislation. And I vaguely remember that day and just going, well, here we are again.
Well, and McBride has actually done some good things as his legislative career has come to an end. So, you know, it is interesting to see how people evolve. I would wonder if he is still as gung-ho about this as he was at that time.
I'm sure I am absolutely confident that he would be, and I'm absolutely confident that similar legislation will be run next session. Yeah.
To try to clean up the mess that was created by this.
Yeah, I mean, unless it gets on appeal in the Supreme Court, we need to talk about all that later. Unless all of that happens before session, yeah. I mean, Treasurer Russ even said in his press release, I believe, that he was looking forward to next legislative session to working on it. So,
but this, I mean, Todd Russ must have just been thrilled beyond belief that, you know, this was sort of a gift to him. I mean, this is right up his alley from his politics. To be able to sort of create an enemies list, if you will, of companies that somehow were engaging in ESG and we're not going to tolerate it here in Oklahoma. We're going to stand up to the big bad ESG woke crowd out there. The problem with that, of course, is it doesn't necessarily help the taxpayers of Oklahoma or pensioners in Oklahoma. It certainly did not help the taxpayers of Stillwater, who, as you recall, ended up costing them money because they were told all of a sudden they couldn't do business with Bank of America for some water and road infrastructure work that they needed. It ended up costing taxpayers more than $1 million more to have to go elsewhere, right?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting about that. I think that to this day, if you look at all the news reports, that's still a true statement as far as what the press has reported. But according to Treasurer Russ at the Senate proceedings on an interim study that was done on this law in October of last year, I think it was October, September of last year, he said that that issue actually ultimately got worked out. But his point to that entire story was that municipalities were not supposed to be included in this legislation. And so their intent was to come forward this session, this past session, and take out municipalities. And there was even legislation to that effect, but it ultimately died. And so you've got those issues. And to your point about costs, according to the Oklahoma Rural Association, it's cost rural Oklahoma $180 million. According to the Oklahoma Public Employees Retirement System, to divest from its current fund manager would cost in excess of $9 million. So there are these real life costs attributable to these types of policies. And, you know, the question is are they economically beneficial? And I don't think we see that proof in the pudding.
So this also, it does seem to have created a dust up between the treasurer and the attorney general over how this whole thing is being handled and played out. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah. And I don't, so I'm not going to personally comment on this because it's, you know, ongoing litigation, those sort of things, right. But yes, what's happened is that originally Treasurer Russ was represented by a private attorney. And after the temporary injunction was granted, Gettner Drummond came out, said, I'm taking over the case. And, you know, in almost every single press piece that I saw about this, essentially, you know, blamed the prior lawyer and Treasurer Russ's decision to hire the prior lawyer instead of using the AG. But I did see one. I did see one where he paid the prior lawyer a compliment. But then after this most recent ruling, again, Attorney General Gettner German came out and said it's because of the bad prior job that was done before. So, and again, blame Treasurer Russ for his choice in the council.
And now he says, we're going to appeal this and perhaps we can get it to the Supreme Court and clean up this mess. I'm not sure exactly what that means. Clean up this mess. Although, I don't know what Treasurer Russ's future political plans are, but certainly everybody seems to think that General Drummond has ambition to hire office. So he's walking a little bit of a tightrope here, because at the end of the day, all this got rolling, and these sorts of things get rolling in the Oklahoma legislature and in the Republican supermajority these days, because it appeals to a fervent part of their base that has excessive stroke in the Republican primaries when you get right down to it, right? And so you're trying to figure out ways to walk this tightrope. You may know that legally it's unconstitutional, it's not going anywhere, but oh, what the heck, we'll vote for it, and we'll virtue signal here, and we'll let the courts clean up, and then we'll complain about the courts.
Well, and that's really the fundamental thing, is if it's true that what the Attorney General argued in their briefs, if it's true that what the legislature intended for this act to do was preclude pension systems from investing based off of ideology and not returns. Okay. Well, first of all, if that's what they wanted to do, they could have simply said it. They didn't need to write 5 sections of law about it. But number two, then this legislation is essentially superfluous, because the Oklahoma Constitution already mandates that you invest solely for the benefit of the returns, right? And without regard to investment ideology. And so it really begs the question of, other than use in political speeches and some speeches around neighborhoods, what's the purpose of this law? I mean, at least to the benefit of taxpayers.
Right, right. Well, clearly money that could have been spent on, public schools, on roads, on healthcare, all sorts of things like that are being spent tilting at windmills in the courthouse unnecessarily. So here we go again with this sort of nonsense. So tell me a little bit about your clients or client in this case, and kind of how this ball got rolling, because it clearly somebody's saw this is a problem, and it's going to end up hurting particularly retirees, or potentially hurt retirees, you'd think, who spent their life's work on behalf of the taxpayers of Oklahoma and were promised certain things at the other end of that willingness to, in most cases, probably make less money than they could have made in the private sector.
Yeah. Yeah. So Don Keenan is an 80-year-old military veteran, retiree of the Sinclair Oil Refinery, former Oklahoma Public Employees Association president, and also an individual who has sworn to never own an electric vehicle. But his objection here isn't necessarily to the policy stance, which is the entire point. His objection is to the fact that these taxpayer dollars are being spent unconstitutionally. And so he wanted to raise this issue, and I was more than happy to help him out, for sure. And so essentially what we alleged were 5 claims. One, that the statute was unconstitutionally vague. 2, that the statute violated what's called the exclusive benefit rule, and it's found in the Oklahoma Constitution, and it essentially says that any and all state pension systems and their assets must be used for the exclusive benefit of the pension beneficiaries. 3, that the statute was violative of the First Amendment, because there's a series of federal cases that hold that the anti-boycott Israel legislation violates the First Amendment. There is one federal court circuit case that found to the contrary, so it's an open question. And then two other claims dealing with the it being a special law or a barrier to the courts, because one of the unique aspects of this law is it quite literally says no one is allowed to bring a lawsuit against this case. I mean, against this statute, period. You just can't do it. Doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter what your claim is, you can't do it. And so those were our claims. And ultimately, the court determined that it was unconstitutionally vague, violative of the exclusive benefit rule, but allowed us to continue to pursue our claims for First Amendment and those other issues. So we'll see how that progresses.
Have you, the last thing that you mentioned about bringing the lawsuit, have you ever seen anything like, I mean, that's.
So the irony is.
That's amazing, right?
There is one other statute that I am aware of that says this. There's two angles to this. So first, there is another statute that says this that I'm aware of, and it's out of Texas, and it's in their anti-boycott statute. But the other thing that's interesting about it is the government, has governmental immunity. That's why we have a Governmental Tort Claims Act. It says you can't sue us unless we tell you you can. And that's all well and good. And, I don't know if it's good, but that's what they can do.
Yeah.
But what they can't do is preclude you from asking a court to examine a statute for constitutionality. And yet, that's what this statute seems to say is prohibited. So at any rate, yeah.
What? I can't decide whether they're just sloppy or they think they're so clever or what on these things.
I really, again, I know that it was a copy and paste job from Alec, but I haven't taken the time since I was in the legislature to actually compare it to the prior versions. But it's clear that this was just a copy and paste job. Yeah.
So what are you hearing from folks who actually are in the front line, for example, of investing state pension fund dollars? It seems to me that, you would, and I can remember a time when, to me, this Republicans, this is totally the opposite of the way that Republicans used to operate. It used to be, you got the most bang for the buck that you could. That was the highest priority in these situations. And there have got to be cases where actually the return for investors is better. Maybe a non-renewable type focused funds, right?
Yeah, so there's two aspects to that. So first, the Attorney General's argument was, listen, I don't even know why we're standing here, because the OPRS board took an exemption. And so therefore, there are no taxpayer pension dollars being expended under this act, period, end of story. Right. And not only that, but the acts can be read so that if they were to invest in it or have to divest from a particular financial company because it boycotted oil and gas and had to go somewhere else, that because of the exemptions in the act for breaches of fiduciary duty, that they could claim an exemption and not have to comply with the act. So in other words, their point is no, you still get the best bang for your buck. You only divest if and only if it wouldn't cost you money. Okay. That's their argument. It's not true, but that's their argument. Now, to your other point about, well, isn't it possible that some of these ESG funds actually make more money than funds that, have oil and gas contained in them? And that's the exact point. So the definition of boycott energy company in the act says essentially, If a company refuses to do business with a company without an ordinary business purpose, that's the key language, without an ordinary business purpose, because the company does, oil and gas work or coal work, then we can't do business with it. Okay. Well, what does without an ordinary business purpose mean there? Because one, we know that these companies that are on the blacklist literally own oil and gas companies, so they can't be boycotting them because they own them. But to the extent that you say, well, you own them as a shareholder and then therefore could drive them into the ground voluntarily, right? Could be doing it without an ordinary business purpose. Okay, so that's theoretically possible. On the flip side of that coin, that same bank has an ESG fund that you can invest in, right? That any, that Colin Walken can go invest in this ESG fund. And guess what that bank does off of my money? They make money. So they have an ordinary business purpose for what they're doing. So either way, JP Morgan Chase can't be on the blacklist. And yet it finds itself sitting there.
So do you get a, do you get any sense at all, other than maybe feeling like there's some sort of negative public relations implication for them, that any of these major companies that I listed who were on the treasurer's latest naughty list, that this is a big deal to them, that that Oklahoma, you know, is playing this game? And I say that, I mean, money's money, and but I'm saying Oklahoma's not a huge player. I mean, it's not like California decided or Texas decided, or, you know, one of the mega states decided to do this. Or have they been sort of in the trenches with you guys to say, you know, this is crazy. You know, we've got to build a firewall, in a sense, from these sorts of things.
I mean, I think they would certainly prefer that this type of legislation not be around, just because it's a PR nightmare. Mm-hmm. But I also don't think for a second that this legislation or any legislation affects their investment decisions, because I don't for a second believe that anybody on Wall Street is there for any reason other than to make money, and as much of it as possible, not to make a political statement. You know, they make a political statement to the extent they need to for PR purposes. They're not really there to actually drive and facilitate change. So I absolutely think that they have an interest from stopping this type of legislation. And this type of legislation could be fought in other states based off of the grounds here, vagueness. And if, because that's a due process clause, so even a federal claim could theoretically be brought. The exclusive benefit rule, you know, our constitution is the longest in the world, has lots of amendments. So I don't know if that one is unique to Oklahoma, or if there are other states that have a similar exclusive benefit rule. I mean, every state does have an exclusive benefit rule to this extent, which is federal law mandates that pension systems is, you know, use their assets solely for the benefit of pensioners. So you would still potentially have a federal claim because of that mandate.
So do you get the sense that for the most part that Oklahoma's pension funds have sort of operated business as usual through this stretch?
I think so, because I think even the treasurer, I mean, I think some may have divested. I actually don't know a count. I couldn't quote anything, but I think it's been fairly status quo. I mean, even the treasurer's office has been status quo. You put Bank of America on the blacklist and continue to do business with Bank of America. So I don't think this law has done much, and it's just part of the performative politics, and that's why it needs to go away.
So what do you think the attorney general is really angling for here in sort of keeping the thing alive? Is he sort of running the clock here in a way for some reason or another, or is there some effort underway to resolve this thing, or is he saying to the legislature, you better fix this thing next year because you're not going to win this?
No, I mean, I think that if he didn't think that he could win it, he probably wouldn't have taken the case over. That's my thought, right? Why would anyone ever take over a sure loser, right? So, I mean, I think he's doing what he believes to be his job as the attorney general and attempting to defend this law. You know, politically, we'll see how that plays out for him.
Well, but, you know, but what would be... I mean, what would be a win in this thing? I it's hard for me to imagine. Well, I'm not a lawyer, but you know, the state Supreme Court would do anything other than say, yeah, well, you know, well, the judge it right.
Yeah, I mean, but you can imagine we have a fairly conservative Supreme Court appointed by, you know, Governor Stitt.
Yes. Yeah, and they've been, the court's been remarkably, see, it's been a firewall, really, and with a lot
I'm not,
of
I'm not criticizing, but it's a matter of perspective on these issues, right? I mean, the vagueness argument, for example. I mean, and so at a minimum, it might be a win to get clarification from the Supreme Court about, okay, if the legislature is going to do this, this is what they have to say, right? I mean, that might be a win in and of itself. But the flip side of the coin is, again, if you've already technically lost, what do you have to lose to try and, you know, change that? Not a lot.
So how much of this, you know, you have alluded several times to this being a cut and paste ALEC bill, American Legislative Exchange Council. How much is this sort of thing reflective of the term limits era in which we're operating here in Oklahoma, where you really don't have the kind of institutional memory at the legislative level that you had once upon a time? Am I tying those things together way too much, do you think?
I mean, I think yes and no. I mean, what you have to remember is the last time that the pension systems dealt with an issue like this was dealing with the anti-apartheid issues back in 1989 and 90. And at that time, they said, no, we're not going to adopt this position because we're here to make money, right? I mean, whatever makes us money is what we're going to do. But I say that because, man, you'd have to have some real long institutional knowledge to have known that, right? I mean, 1989, 1990, I was 8.
But you know, there have been in the past people who served that long, you know,
that's right.
Period of time for sure. And really, if you think about it in you know, in the great scheme of history, a lot of that stuff, it's a little bit like, you know, Medicaid managed care. You know, it's like we tried that once before and it was a disaster, and there's a reason that we let the OHCA handle that, and now we decide we want to go back to it again. And what's happened? You know, people are losing their minds because the, you know, healthcare providers aren't getting reimbursed. I mean, you know, all the same kinds of things that happened before, and somebody's siphoning off a bunch of that money that was going to them in a much more timely fashion previously.
If you'll recall, I handled that Medicaid case that said this was exactly what was going to happen.
Yes. But I guess my point is, yeah, you know, there isn't the institutional memory, but if you're thinking back even to the apartheid era, it's not like ancient history. It's not like, oh gosh, that happened in the Gilded Age of the early 20th century. I mean, it's, you know, it's not that far back, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't disagree with you, but again, I'm willing to bet in 2022, I didn't know that fact. And I bet you none of the legislators on the floor knew that fact. You know, that we had dealt with this in 1989. I learned that as a result of this, you know, so maybe, but what I do agree, what I do think is a problem is that there's clearly a concerted national effort at all state legislative levels to influence legislation from a national perspective. And that's the problem.
So what constitutes, other than just absolutely killing the law outright? I mean, and what you have is a permanent injunction, you know, now. So, I mean, that's in effect killed it. Does that constitute a victory then, you know, from your client's standpoint in all this? Or is there something further that you all would like to see that makes clear to the legislature that, you know, you pursue this kind of nonsense at your own peril?
Yeah, I mean, I think a victory is always sufficient in court. I've been doing this long enough. And Don is quite pleased with the outcome of the situation. You know, the thing is that, and I think this is especially true with our Supreme Court, we've seen it with the abortion cases, et cetera. And it's the proper thing to do, which is, justices tend to, when ruling on issues, limit themselves to the issues and the ruling in that case and not make broad sweeping pronouncements. You know, you'll find it on occasion, but rarely. And I think that's the right thing to do, because I think, so absent a First Amendment issue, so take First Amendment out of this. If you take the First Amendment out of this, I think there's a way to write this statute in a way that is constitutional. They just didn't do it here. So that's the problem, right?
So what does that sort of look like without getting too technical or down in the weeds here? But what would that sort of thing, and would it be something that Don could live with, for example?
You know, I don't know the answer to that from Don's perspective, for sure. What I would say is what it would look like is simply that, which is, you know, anytime a pension system is making an investment decision, it's not supposed to take into consideration ideology. And in no event shall it ever invest contrary to the Oklahoma Constitution or any other fiduciary by statute or common law, because that's one of the things that this statute does. It exempts them from their statutory or common law duties, i.e. their fiduciary duties. Title 47, Section 909, which is what OPRS relied upon as one of the exemptions. Well, guess what? Technically, that statute exempts them from complying with that statute. The one thing the statute can't exculpate them from complying with it is the Constitution, right? Mm-hmm. So I think if they didn't try and exempt them from these other fiduciary duties out there, and they simply said, just don't take it into consideration, but in any event, whether you do or don't, you can't violate. I think you get there then.
Well, okay, that's. I think we would agree that is common sense.
Yeah.
Is there value in actually codifying in law specifically a common sense, or is it just like, of course it's common sense?
No, I think there is, because they want a PR piece. That's the reason why they ran this. They want to say, we've done something. Here's your opportunity to say you've done something. I mean, it's just, not to bring it back to data privacy, but it's just like today, we're seeing at the federal level, the Senate's moving two children's bills because they recognize the harms that social media presents. And guess what? They're not doing anything about adults, right? I mean, we regulate addictive behavior all of the time, but we're not doing it here. And so it's because it's easy to do things for the children. It's harder to do things for adults with autonomy. So
yeah. So let's talk for just a minute in all this about the Supreme Court and the court system here in Oklahoma, because you know there have been a lot of efforts, particularly on the right, the hard right, to try to politicize the courts, take us back in a lot of ways to the bad old days of picking justices and kind of making it a wild, wild west again. Is this another example of the wisdom of the system that we are operating under, you know, post the Corn era and, you know, the early 60s, late 50s and early 60s and so forth? And another reason why the taxpayers of Oklahoma ought to be paying close attention to make sure that the legislature doesn't find ways to monkey with the system and politicize it, as they've done really in Texas, the legislature in Texas. You know, I mean, it's the Texas system's a mess.
No, I absolutely agree. You know, I think we have a strong bench in Oklahoma County. I think, you know, most of the counties I've been in, we've got a strong bench. Cleveland County. Even the Supreme Court, even though they handed me my rear on the Medicaid case, I feel like they were, that they're all good justices, that they follow the law, and that they're not there for ideological reasons per se. And I feel like we've got a great bench, and I fail to understand why we continue to search for solutions or have solutions in search of a problem. So, yeah, completely agree.
Which is, of course, this is a poster child. This particular law is a poster child for that sort of performance politics, I suppose.
Yeah.
Well, hey, listen, I know you're a busy man and you have billable hours that go beyond your public service to ObserverCast listeners. So, but it was great to see you again. And hopefully we can sort of keep the conversation going on these things and make sure that folks who tune in to us and Oklahomans at large have a better understanding of what the legislature's doing and doing to them, as opposed oftentimes to for them.
Right. Always happy to chat, Arnold.
All right. Good seeing you. You all have a good one.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ObserverCast. If you like what you hear, please tell your friends about us and share our episodes far and wide on social media. If you're interested in sponsoring ObserverCast, please give Arnold Hamilton a call at 405-478-8700 or drop him an email at ahamilton@okobserver.org. You can also support ObserverCast with a tax-deductible donation to the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation, whose mission is to help create a better, more informed Oklahoma. And to help keep us on the air, visit okobserver.org and click on the Donate button on the upper right side of the homepage. We also urge you to subscribe to the Oklahoma Observer, now in its 55th year of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. We have a special digital subscription rate for ObserverCast listeners, only $1.99 a month for the first year. That's 50% off the usual rate for monthly digital subscribers. Just use the coupon code ObserverCast when checking out to get the discount rate. And finally, we want to thank Jared Deck for the music you're listening to in the background here. He's not just a resident of Norman anymore. He is now the Oklahoma State Representative for House District 44. Congratulations, Representative Deck. We're so proud of you. But you can still download his albums at iTunes and learn more, including dates for any upcoming performances at jareddeckmusic.com.